would ask the committee members to
rotate,
and I will call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and we will, you will note on the agenda this morning that we have listed the economic and revenue forecast, the May forecast. That forecast is being delivered to the Revenue Committee this morning, as is tradition, and when they arrive, we will jump in our agenda and fit that forecast in at some point in our agenda this morning. We will begin with, Representative Westland is not here. Neither is Representative Matt. All right. Let's begin. No, yes, please do, but let's begin with House Bill 5059, Senator Yee. Sorry, Senator.
Hi.
I don't know where my house numbers are.
You're out late, I don't
know.
Madam Chair. House Bill 5059 is transfers resources among the 9 divisions and offices of Department of Human Resources to balance the agency's current biennium budget. About every 6 months, the department appears before the emergency board or the legislative assembly to revise its budget to reflect caseload and other changes that affect costs. Savings in some programs are used to offset shortfalls in other areas. The rebalancing process was established in statute as a way to reduce the need for emergency funds or supplemental appropriations to address budgetary problems. This is the fourth rebalance plan for the current biennium. Overall, the adjustments saved $7.6 million general fund, primarily due to caseload and cost per case reductions. The bill disappropriates $11.2 million general fund based on some of these savings, along with $3.2 million savings identified in November 1998 rebalance and a $1.4 million fund shift of tobacco tax savings in the Children's Health Insurance Program. These funds are now available for the 1999 to 2001 budget users. Caseload and operating cost adjustments would have reduced other and federal funds expenditures by the total of $37.1 million. However, these operating reductions are offset with expenditure limitation increases for 2 fund shifts that will generate more revenue for next biennium. The Senior and Disabled Services Division will increase public nursing home reimbursement rates to the upper limit allowed by Medicare based on expenditure limitation increases and provider reimbursement rule changes approved in the rebalance plan. This will add about $29 million in revenue to the state for 1999 to 2001. The bill adds other federal funds expenditure limitations for the Office of Medical Assistance Program to accommodate the pass-through of federal graduate medical education funding to the Oregon Health Sciences University. Oregon Health Sciences University has agreed to return $7.5 million of an $18.2 million increase in federal Medicaid funding received this biennium to help resolve a 9901 shortfall for the Oregon State Mental Hospital, whose federal funds have been reduced. A budget note acknowledges this one-time payment and clarifies that the 2001 to 2003 biannual budget request should not continue the pass-through arrangement. This rebalance continues to address the agency's year 2000 needs, focusing on replacement of non-compliant desktop and non-mainframe hardware and software. funds for this will be unscheduled by the Department of Administrative Services, pending further review of the testing tools and replacement methodology. This is a good rebalance plan, very complicated, which resolves the agency's current biennial needs and generates about $47.7 million to address budget priorities in the coming biennium. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means urges passage of House Bill 5859. In summary, because of reduction in caseload and operating costs, we should see a reduction in federal and other funds, because we are asking for two fund shifts, two increase in federal matches and fund shifts. We are able to receive more money. You are not seeing any reduction. You are seeing an increase in funding. As I mentioned in the pony, that the medical school is going to put in $11 million and ask for the teaching grant that will allow them to receive, they put in 11.8, they will be able to get 16.2 million federal Medicaid match, and they can pay the mental hospital, Oregon Mental Hospital, which is receiving a reduction in federal funds in $7.5 million. And because SDSD is applying for a federal match by increasing the Medicare limit, they are going to put in a state match of $19 million and receive $29.5 million federal match. So that's why we are going to see a $47.7 million increase in funding after the rebalancing. And we are also asking the agency to spend more of their other funds on federal funds and less of their general funds. And this will free up general funds to go back to ending balance and available for next session use. I hope I have made it clear.
Thank you very much, Senator. Okay, Ross.
I was a no vote in committee and will be a no vote here. However, I want to say that staff has done a very good job with this effort, and that's specifically why I want to explain my no vote. The department had made arrangements had worked hard to save general fund dollars, and they wanted to push specified designated other funds into the new biennium to save money in the new biennium. The committee decided that they did not want to do this, and so they are capturing these general fund savings now to provide flexibility to the committee and to make conscious decisions about filling those holes in the budget. This action does create an $11 million hole in the department's plan, and I have been assured by the chair of the committee that we will look at each of these holes consciously and make a conscious decision on refilling each one of those. And that's actually all I'm asking for, is that we look at the holes that have been created by this action and make deliberate decisions about whether or not it is appropriate to fill those as we complete the budget. And so that was my reason for voting no. My concern is that if departments try very hard to save general fund dollars and then we come along with a scoop and scoop those up, that we provide a disincentive for departments to be honest about their savings, and we provide an incentive for them to hide funds. I do not think this is the case in the Department of Human Resources, and I think that staff has done a very good job about identifying these general funds and providing extra flexibility to the committee. So that's an explanation of my no vote.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Fisher.
Yes, you have potential conflict of interest on this particular bill because it does contain some potential funding for the nursing home industry, which I'm a nursing home owner operator.
Thank you. Are there further questions on the rebalance? Are there no further comments? Are there further objections, or can Ross is there an objection? Are there further objections to the rebalance? Okay. Hearing none, with Representative Ross voting no, House Bill 5059, the Department of Human Resource 1997 is passed to the floor with a U-Pass recommendation. Okay, we will now go back to House Bill 5014, Representative Westland.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 5014 is the budget bill for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. The Commission's primary responsibility is to develop the state criminal justice policy and long-range comprehensive public safety plan for Oregon. The Commission also provides analytical and statistical information to federal agencies, serves as a clearinghouse and information center for the collection, preparation, analysis, and dissemination of state and local sentencing practices, provides technical assistance to the local public safety coordinating councils, and is responsible for adopting sentencing guidelines. The recommended total budget is $1.2 million. This amount provides sufficient resources to maintain all current services. The budget is supported by 693,000 general funds, 67,000 other funds, and 409,000 federal funds. The subcommittee reduced the governor's budget by $22.4 million. Most of these reductions are based on plans to address expenditures for juvenile crime prevention efforts through separate policy legislation that is currently being developed. The remaining reductions are based on plans to shift allowable expenditures to federal funds based on available grant funds. The subcommittee directed the commission to work with other criminal justice agencies to develop a work plan for a state criminal justice policy and comprehensive long-range plan. To ensure progress is made, the commission is also directed to provide reports to the emergency board. The subcommittee unanimously recommends approval of the budget.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Westland. Are there any questions for Representative Westland? Representative Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment on regards to this commission. I voted for it. I have some serious reservations about whether this commission is doing what it's statutorily mandated to do. That's why we put in this budget note. I want to watch this carefully during the interim and would encourage my other colleagues to do that to make sure that they maintain their course and the mission in which they're statutorily mandated to do.
Any comment, Representative
Westland? I appreciate Representative Packard's comments. I tend to agree with them, but I think we've got to acknowledge that their charge, their mission statement, if you will, is an extremely difficult goal to achieve. That is why we put in a fairly rigorous budget note that directed them to report to develop a work plan for developing a state criminal justice policy and report to the E-Board, I believe it was by February, and then to the our last E-Board before next session starts with progress they've made on that work plan. And that is, I mean, that work plan in terms of developing the comprehensive collaborative justice system should include Department of Corrections, Oregon Youth Authority, Department of State Police, Public Defender, Department of Justice, and the Judicial Branch. It's a fairly steep road we've given them, and I will be helping them hold their feet to the fire with you, Representative Patridge. I think Mr. Lemon is very pleased by this budget note.
Very good. Are there some further comments on this budget? Seeing none, are there any objections to the passage of House Bill 5014? Hearing none, House Bill 5014 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Let's move on to House Bill 5045, Representative Minnis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 5045 is a budget bill for the state public defender. The public defender provides legal representation to indigent defendants when trial court judgments are appealed. The governor's budget included an unspecified increase of $107,138 and 12.5 unfunded FTE. The subcommittee action deleted these FTE and the unspecified increase, which returned the budget to the current service level. The subcommittee adjustments are to the current service level. The workload of the public defender has suddenly increased. The 1997 legislature approved the limited duration attorney and clerical position to address workload. If you receive additional resources, the agency has a backlog of 236 appeals. Each year, the agency receives over 300 more appeals than it can handle. The backlog and excess appeals are the annual workload or over five attorneys. If not handled by the public defender, the cases will be assigned to private counsel at a higher cost per appeal. The public safety sub recommends a budget increase of $184,211 to retain the two limited duration positions. These positions are needed for the current workload. The subcommittee also recommends a budget increase of $585,280 for three attorneys and two support positions for the additional workload. The subcommittee urged the agency to work on the backlog, but recognize that the backlog may not be eliminated in the 1999-01 biennium. The subcommittee deferred action on several issues, including salary parity with the Attorney General and staff workload standards, pending action on a bill to establish a public defender corporation. If the corporation is not established, the legislature will need to consider these issues. The subcommittee also approved a $40,000 supplemental appropriation for the 1997-99 biennium. These costs came from an unanticipated move and need to use temporary resources to assist death penalty attorneys with their workload. The subcommittee recommends approval of a budget of $5,491,125 general fund and a supplemental appropriation of $40,000 for the public defender.
Any questions for us 5 minutes? No questions. Okay. All right. Are there any objections to the passage of House Bill 5045? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 5045 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And that brings us to Senate Bill 5503. Senator Coe.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Senate Bill 5503 is the budget for the Capital Planning Commission. The commission establishes and implements long-range plans for development of state-owned properties and reviews and approves additions to or proposed changes to state-owned buildings in Marion and Polk counties. The commission's 1999-01 budget is $248,200 other funds, which pay for 1.63 FTE. It reflects an increase of 10.4% over the 1997-99 estimated expenditures. The budget continues all commission activities and includes one policy package to allow the commission to obtain maintenance agreements for its equipment and to allow access to the Internet to receive and distribute electronic data correspondence documentation. Subcommittee recommends approval. I don't know if you've read the budget bill. I think you notice also that we've put a budget note in the budget material, which just indicates that we'd like a little better notification from the commission to the legislators about plans they may have to build either in the Capitol Mall or generally on state property, so we have some advance notice of what's going on.
Good, Senator Fisher.
Yes, where do these other funds come from?
These other funds basically are charges to state agencies.
Are there any further questions on this budget? Seeing none, are there any objections to the passage of Senate Bill 5503? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 5503 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And that brings us to Senate Bill 5521, Senator Pita.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Senate Bill 5521 is a budget bill for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the agency promotes development of high-skilled, competitive workforce in Oregon and provides workforce protection and development, encourages and enforces compliance with state employment laws, and regulates apprenticeship activities. The agency is funded primarily with general fund. It receives other funds for civil rights investigations and the administration of wage security fund payments. The agency also receives federal funds for training qualified veterans and for civil rights investigations. The recommended budget is $19,435,285 and 129 FTE. This is a 4% increase over the 97-99 legislatively approved budget. The general fund portion was decreased 2.6% from the governor's recommended budget. The subcommittee also approved a package which reduced the agency's general fund an additional 2.5%. Other funds packages were approved for the hearings unit case presenter and compliance staff to handle increased workload in investigations of prevailing wage rate violations. The subcommittee approved an other funds limitation increase to accommodate passage of House Bill 2027, which provides education for public contracting and purchasing law. Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee recommends your approval.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions on Senate Bill 5521? No? Okay. Are there any objections to the passage of Senate Bill 5521? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 5521 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We are going to move to House Bill 2005, Representative Messer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 2005 creates a 9-member cultural joint interim task force and establishes a $200,000 general fund appropriation for the task force activities. The task force will continue the work begun by the governor's task force on cultural development that was appointed in June of 1998. The task force will develop a plan to preserve Oregon's cultural heritage, promote collaboration among arts, heritage, education, and community organizations, and develop benchmarks to measure progress. The Economic Development Department will provide temporary staff to support the commission. The bill also creates a cultural trust fund investment account. The issue of state support for the account will be considered in another bill. Task force will develop criteria for the use of funds in the account. The General Government Subcommittee recommends approval.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Zoe. Are there any questions on House Bill 2005? Okay. Are there any objections to the passage of House Bill 2005? Senator Fisher.
Do I have to declare a conflict of interest being a Harley-Davidson owner?
if you like, Senator. Yes, Senator Ferriello.
The good senator refers to a note that I... An example that I used in discussing the definition of culture, I wanted to make sure that the humanities and social sciences were well represented in our cultural support in identifying cultural events, but also that county fairs, rodeos, and other cultural events that define Oregon as uniquely Oregon got included in the definition of culture. And I invite everybody to have a brush with culture here in Eastern Oregon with a rodeo or a county fair.
Sandra, we have county fairs even over here in the Willamette Valley.
I know the county fair that is going to take place on Mud.
Well.
How dare you.
We wait until August to have our senator so that we don't have much. Any other comments on House Bill 2005? Okay. I think that this was something I know the governor had support for in his budget, and we're pleased to also support this whole concept of having a cultural task force, and I'm pleased to see the support on the committee.
Madam Senator. The Speaker of the House was very supportive of this program endeavor, too, so she should also receive some.
Yes, I think this is the Speaker's bill. It is.
I believe so, too.
Okay. Okay, Jen, are there any objections to the passage of House Bill 2005? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 2005 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I believe we will assign this to Speaker Snodgrass to carry if she would like to do so. Okay, we'll move on to House Bill
2092. Representative Ross.
House Bill 2092 creates an Oregon Resource Technology Development Account in the Education Endowment Fund. The Oregon Resource and Technology Development Fund provides early stage venture capital for small business. This measure arose from the Attorney General opinion that held that ORTDF could not hold stock in companies in which it invests. The transfer, this change transfers ORTDF assets to the Education Endowment Fund, enabling the fund to make the investment. The Senate Trade and Economic Development Committee referred this to Ways and Means. The measure has a minimal potential fiscal impact for contract services to administer the account. No appropriation or limitation is needed. The Education Subcommittee recommends approval.
Very good. Are there any questions for Representative Ross? Okay. See none. Are there any objections to the passage of House Bill 2092? Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 2092 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the piece is going to the House floor first, Representative Ross, and Representative Ross is carrier. And now we will move to House Bill 2704, Representative Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2704 comes to you from the House Committee on Human Resources. It creates a five-member board of athletic trainers. I might also add it came through our subcommittee of general government. It creates a five-member board of athletic trainers in the health division. The purpose of this new board is to protect the public against unregistered and untrained individuals involved in fitness training and conditioning generally conducted in association with an educational institution or professional or amateur sports activity. Currently, registration is voluntary. Anyone may conduct business in this field without specified training, education, or certification and be called an athletic trainer. House Bill 2704 requires mandatory registration of all athletic trainers. The board will adopt rules to establish training and education requirements, determine qualifications and documentation, a code of professional responsibility and standards, and registration fees to cover the cost of operating the board and its activities. In addition, the board will be granted authority to investigate complaints and take disciplinary action. The board will require staffing of 1.5 FTE. The fiscal impact is estimated to be approximately $170,000 per biennium and is funded totally from registration fees and licenses. The Athletic Trainers Association supports House Bill 2704. The General Government Committee made no amendment to the bill, and we recommend passage of House Bill 2704.
Thank you, Representative Leonard. Are there any questions for Representative Leonard on this bill? And Representative Crummell has joined us in case there are questions. Senator Speaker.
Thank you. I was wondering what exactly the problem is.
Currently, as I mentioned just briefly in my remarks, individuals can actually identify themselves as athletic trainers, and services provided by them may not reflect the training necessary to actually be a qualified athletic trainer. And this bill would require that those minimum standards be established. And
Representative Leonard, I heard what you said. I guess, and I did listen. What I was asking is, has there been a problem where there's been injuries or an indication of actual injuries because these people didn't know what they were doing?
Actually, we have Representative Crummell here. It's his bill. Maybe he'd like to
talk
to that.
Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Crummell. I'm a state representative from House District 27. To answer your question, Senator, the problem that exists is that, as Representative Leonard mentioned, is that when you say athletic trainer, there is a level of expectation. And within the state, there still is a situation where we can have the competencies not meeting that level of expectation. Luckily, in the state of Oregon, we've been pretty fortunate from the standpoint that we have not had a catastrophic injury occur to an athlete and have the athlete be mishandled. However, in Washington, they've not been so lucky. There is on record two injuries that have occurred. Both of them were spinal injuries. in football. The injuries were not well taken care of, and they both players ended up in a quadriplegic state. And it can be attributed back to the mishandling of the injury. Athletic trainers are trained in the emergency care for everything from closed head injuries all the way to open fractures and visceral injuries and so on. Even when there's EMTs on the sidelines, the athletic trainer is the first responder and then directs the care from that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Schrader.
I assume this bill enjoys pretty broad support within the industry itself.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, it does. It has been talked about quite a while. This is a project that I personally have been working on for about the last 22 years, and it does have broad support. The fees are a little bit of a concern, but the people in the industry are saying yes, they would like to have a regulation set on their practice so that they can make sure that the public is protected with respect to when you are being treated by an athletic trainer, that it's a person that knows what they're doing.
Go ahead.
Question, Richard. I assume, like in all these startup boards, that the money that's being appropriated at this point will be paid back as the boards get up and running?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, that's correct. There is a from the current voluntary registration, there is a small cash carry forward, and that plus the fact that some of the, and actually I probably should let Sue Wilson talk about this, but as the fees come in, that would cover the cost.
Just a quick comment to follow. I think this is a real good bill. I think I am a slightly different health industry, and I know just even mere bandaging incorrectly can cause serious, serious problems. And so you do need to have qualified professionals, and I know Wilson McCrummel's worked very hard on this for a long time. It's a good addition to public safety here in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Commissioner
Blessman. Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, would like to compliment Representative Crummell for his line work on this bill, very dedicated work and the good work of the subcommittee. This is an excellent bill, and I support it wholeheartedly.
Are there any further questions? Senator Bryant.
We try to do it on a voluntary basis, apparently, and I remember a little about this because I think the legislature wasn't convinced of the need of requiring a resignation or the registration in order to assure the training. And the instances you mentioned, I would imagine school districts would have a responsibility to make sure the people who treat athletes have the proper
training,
otherwise they'd be subject to liability. I think so that's my concern here. I don't know quite understand how broad the scope would be, but would this restrict then someone from using the term athletic trainer unless they were a member of this association?
Madam Chair, Senator Bryant, yes, it would. However, volunteers and coaches and people that are involved with the schools, as long as they are not calling themselves the athletic trainer, then there's nothing wrong with them, you know, putting an ice bag on an injury or taping an ankle, you know, that sort of thing. The bill, if you look in section one, does list in subsection 4 the scope of practice. And the scope of the five areas that are listed there are five of the six areas of domain that are identified by the National Athletic Trainers Association in conjunction with the AMA, American Medical Association, as being the areas that athletic trainers should be heavily involved with. The sixth area that's not listed is athletic administration, and it wasn't felt that needed to be put into the statute because that's more it's an administrative function as opposed to a clinical function.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. There was testimony given regarding the national associations. There is a national license, and that a number of people in Oregon have the national license.
I guess I have a concern of the number of people who have joined in the voluntary program to pay $50 of the 60 members that are nationally recognized now, having a national certification. I have a concern of this going from 50 to 225 or 250, whatever the anticipation is. And that is still a concern. Are you still grappling with that, Representative?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, yes, but I have been in contact with leaders in the association, and they have made some calls around, and they have told me that although they're concerned about the cost of the registration, they still want to move forward with it. The biggest problem being that, yes, there is a national certification. However, it's not recognized in Oregon statute. What there is a voluntary registration that's recognized, but there's no scope of practice listed in that. So consequently, with regards to the term athletic trainer, you still have a situation where existing where people can call themselves an athletic trainer when in fact they don't have the background and training to back it up. And that's what we're talking about, is that with the level of expectation and the level of competency, we want to make sure that the competency level is there with the level of expectation.
Representative
Patrick. I have two questions. One, what do other states do in regards to this? And two, what, in terms of insurance or any of those kinds of things, in terms of those billings, is this an advantage, disadvantage for the consumers that are out there? How does that work? How does that certification work if you were to be injured and have insurance and you go to an athletic training?
Madam Chair, Representative Patrick, thank you. A couple of things. One is, first of all, to your first question with regards to what other states are doing, 37 other states have some form of regulation of athletic trainers. It ranges everywhere from programs such as Oregon, which is there's only a couple of them, which is a voluntary registration, all the way up to a full licensing such as what they have in Texas. And it ranges whether you're in the Northeast or the Southeast or the Southwest or the Northwest. There's a variety. Idaho has a full licensing that is actually administered by their Board of Medical Examiners. Texas has a full licensing as well. I'm trying to think what are the other states that have a voluntary registration. I believe it's Ohio. And then there's, as I mentioned, there's everything in between. With regards to billings, as it stands now, somebody could hang out a shingle, say that they're an athletic trainer, and charge for their services. That's not a problem. The problem that would come in is with regards to third-party billing or third-party pay. With regards to the insurance companies, there is not a mandate in here that says that insurance companies must reimburse for the services. It was felt that that's not something that should be mandated. If the insurance companies want to cover it because the scope of practice is listed in statute, that would be a side consequence or a side benefit, depending on how you want to look at it. And I believe that the market should take care of that if there's going to be any type of third-party reimbursement. 50% of the athletic trainers nationwide work in a clinical type situation, and what I mean by that is that they work in a physical therapy clinic or they work in a doctor's clinic, and they provide a variety of services for physically active people. In some states they are reimbursed by insurance payers, and in some states they're not, and it just depends on how the insurance industry in that particular state wants to view them. Irrespective of that, I think the important thing is to note that with the scope of practice being listed, if somebody does hang out their shingle and say that they're an athletic trainer, then in the state of Oregon, they're going to know that they're going to a qualified person for the types of injuries. And as you note in Section 1, athletes and athletic injury are also identified and described in terms of what constitutes an athletic injury and what constitutes an athlete. That way you don't end up with a person that is you know, had a stroke trying to go to an athletic trainer and being taken care of, and having the athletic trainer trying to treat them because it is outside, clearly outside of their scope of care.
Are there further questions?
The fiscal sheet tells us that most athletic trainers are in high schools and colleges and work with high school and college students. Are they employed as employees of the school district generally?
Mm-hmm.
And if that is the case, have we taken into account, would this be something that would be paid for them through the school district, their fee, their registration fee?
I would imagine that'd be a source of
bargaining
between the...
And do you know, Randy, whether, Representative Leonard, whether bargaining for this kind of thing is usually, whether that is bargained into their contract?
Taking myself for an example, I'm responsible for an annual fee to maintain an EMT certification, and the fire bureau does pay that.
Oh.
They volunteered to pay that, so... I'm assuming because the nature of what Representative Crummell is asking for is the same. The certification would assure parents and students that if a student was injured. Traumatic football injury or some other type of cardiac injury, that the person responsible for the immediate first care has that minimum level of training, understanding the techniques of CPR, immobilization of the spine if there is some kind of a head injury. Most governmental entities want to be able to assure the parents that this individual has meet that level of training. So
I understand that part of it, but that leads to my other question, which is that included in our business? What it's going to cost through this?
No. And it would be a source of a subject of button.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to follow up on an item that Senator Bryant has brought up, and that is, I didn't realize this had been discussed in the prior legislature, I wanted to ask Representative Crummell, did you consider the possibility not allowing or introducing legislation that wouldn't allow people to hang up shingles that would say certified athletic trainer or athletic trainer, but would allow them to hang up a shingle that would say nationally board certified athletic trainer? Was that contemplated at all?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, over the years, there's been a lot of different ideas that have been contemplated. The use of somebody calling themselves an athletic trainer, if they are nationally certified, doesn't necessarily give the consumer, if they were to hang up a shingle, doesn't necessarily give the consumer any recourse if number one, they really aren't nationally certified, or if they are in a malpractice type situation, other than their only recourse would be to go back to the person personally. And what I mean by that would be, you know, hopefully the person is carrying a malpractice insurance, and so if they mistreated the person, the injured party then could file suit against the individual. But as far as having any kind of a state standard to meet, there would not be any recourse in that respect.
Follow up.
Mr. Butler?
I just want to make sure you're not indicating that the board would have any liability for malpractice.
No.
As with having a state standard.
I
might also add that, as I understand Representative Crummell's previous explanation of the bill, that Section 1, Sub 4 actually establishes a scope of practice that isn't necessarily reflected in the national certification.
Madam Chair and Representative Leonard, these are the six domains that three different delineation studies that have been performed by the National Athletic Trainers Association have been shown to be these are the areas that athletic trainers are competent to work in under their standards. And
somebody just sets up a limitation beyond which athletic trainers would not be allowed to treat individuals. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Leonard, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Natomo. Well, if there's no further questions, are there any objections to the passage of House Bill 2704? Senator Bryant, are there any other objections? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 2704 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, with Senator Bryant voting no and Representative Ross excused. And I would like to ask Representative Leonard, you're listed as a carrier. Would it be all right if Representative Crummell carries the bill?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Representative Leonard. And thank you, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we have our folks from to give us the revenue forecast this morning, and we'd like to welcome Tom Petowski and Sarah Gates.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming this morning, I believe. The Deputy Director is casting out information for us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Right ahead.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, Representative Lewis, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Timms, and members of the Joint House and Ways Dean Committee. For the record, I'm Tom Petowski, acting state economist and professor and chair of the economics department at Portland State University. With me today is Sarah Gates, economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. We were hoping to be joined by Ralph Shaw, Shaw Ventures. He's also the chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, and he was detained in Bend, Oregon. The Office of Economic Analysis, located in the Department of Administrative Services, produces quarterly economic and revenue forecasts. During the legislative session, our June 1 forecast is produced early, May 15th, to provide you with the necessary economic and revenue numbers for your budgetary process. To assist us in this forecasting process, we have two advisory groups. Our first group is the Department of Administrative Services Economic Advisory Committee. It consists of 15 economists employed mainly by state agencies. And the second group is our Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. This is a group of 12 economists from academia and private industry, and includes a wide variety of individuals, especially from private industry. We have a venture capitalist, a wheat farmer, a forestry economist, people from utilities, and so forth. So our report today, what we'll do is start with a quick overview of economic conditions. We'll follow by assessment of the Oregon economy, and then we'll conclude with Sarah Gates with the revenue forecast. And just want to tell you that the particular order of this presentation isn't to keep you in anticipation of the numbers, but to sort of illustrate really the point that the economic conditions do influence what the revenue forecast will be. Our publication that you just have in front of you, the purple one, is entitled The Oregon Economic and Revenue Forecast. I want to emphasize that title in that it's not two publications. It's not a separate one for the economy and a separate one for revenue. The two are really intertwined with one another, and if we're going to see where revenues are headed, we'll have to see where the economy is headed. As example, even though we hear a lot about Greenspan, and he seems to be out there somewhere in Washington, D.C., he has a great influence on us. Now, if Greenspan decides to raise interest rates, that will directly affect Oregon businesses and families here. That will in turn affect their profits and people's incomes, and that in turn will affect revenues, tax revenues that come into the state. So I want to start just quick. I'm sure all of you have heard so much about how wonderful this economy is these days, especially the overall U.S. economy, the best in 30 years, the lowest inflation rate in 30 years, lowest unemployment rate in 30 years. Just the analogies go back and back to our longest expansion period, which was in the 1960s. And it looks like this expansion period, which is rapidly approaching its 108th month, will surpass that and be our longest post-World War II expansion. if you turn to page one in the short press packet that you have, it's called summary. You have a little bit of a rundown on some of the recent developments for the Oregon economy. What we've seen recently is the Oregon economy grew rather briskly in the first quarter of 1999. Once again, this is led by mostly consumer spending. The only slight drag on the economy, once again, came because of the Asian crisis. Although that's starting to alleviate some of the pain that our manufacturing sector has seen. High-tech unemployment still saw some large declines, but we believe that's starting to bottom out. We've also seen some firming up of commodity prices, which is hopefully going to help, even though they're still weak, forest products and agricultural sectors. On page three, we give you a little comparison of how Oregon has fared relative to its neighbors, other states in the U.S. We slowed considerably relative to California and to Washington. Main reason for this is the Asian crisis. Our manufacturing sector, especially high-tech, and forestry, and agriculture, is a little more sensitive to the Asian economies than both Washington and California are. And we felt a little bit deeper the effect of their downturn. Down below, we have projected growth for our top U.S. export markets. Our three main top export markets are Canada, Japan, and South Korea. As you can see, in 1999, South Korea is coming back a little bit from its downturn that experienced mostly through 97 and 98. Canada is still strong, and Japan hopefully will be bottoming out and returning to some stronger growth. And that bodes well, then, for those sectors I just mentioned. On page four, we have some mystery charts because a legend is missing. The dark bar is the Oregon economy, and the clear bar is for the U.S. So you can think about these three charts as comparison of Oregon with sort of the overall average U.S. And the main point here to get is the comparison of 94 through about 97, and then as we get into the 99, 2000, 2001 period. What we've seen is very fantastic, really, growth, 94 through 97, relative especially compared to the U.S. Then we get a little bit of a hit in 1998. We returned to some growth faster than the U.S. But if you take a look at that chart, you'll see that the growth is still positive and still relatively strong, but not like we've seen in the past. Positive growth, but not as strong. That's true for overall employment, the middle graph of manufacturing employment, same story. Not as positive growth, though, in those out years, but not like we've seen. The strong, fast pace of 94 through 97. And true, too, with the non-manufacturing employment also. So that's sort of the basic story here. We're seeing growth occurring, returning, stronger growth than we saw in 98, but not the pace that was experienced in the mid-1990s. Turning to page five, we see that we're progressively doing a little better because we're growing a little faster than the U.S. economy on average. We're seeing that Oregon's share of total personal income is starting to improve relative to the U.S. and slowly reaching up back to its 1979 levels, although it's a long 20-year road to travel, but things are improving. The bottom graph also showing the basic same story, looking at Oregon per capita income relative to the U.S. and also the wage rate. Then, page six, this page is lets you know that our forecast, and I wouldn't want to say our forecast can be characterized as like over-optimistic or too conservative. Really looking for the most likely outcome. Well, what's sort of the middle-of-the-road belief of how the economy is going to change? But there can be risks to that outlook. And I'd like to give you just a quick quote from Alan Greenspan, because everyone seems when they quote him that they believe it must be true. As you know, he can be a little convoluted, and it's hard to read through the lines. This quote isn't that much different, but he still gets his message across. He stated last week, "The remarkable American economy, whose roots are still not conclusively known, and the Asian crisis
that caught us by surprise, among other humbling experiences, have made policymakers particularly sensitive to how fast the world can shift beneath our feet. And so here we are projecting out 2 years, and it's our best look of what's happening, but surprises can happen. We don't like to have surprises, but there are things beyond your forecasting control. And so these risk factors, just want to turn to some of these here, in macroeconomic policies, just mentioned Alan Greenspan, and what we're looking here is we don't believe the Federal Reserve is going to move to any policy to sort of boost the economy further. The economy is very, very strong. If anything, the Federal Reserve is going to err on the side of trying to slow things down. So we see a possible mild downside from the Federal Reserve in possibly raising interest rates. Maybe not this next week. They're meeting this coming Tuesday, even though the news that just came out with the Consumer Price Index showed a 0.7% increase overall. If you take away the high energy prices and food, the core rate was a 0.4%. But that's still, for a monthly rate, a 9-year high. But 1 month doesn't necessarily make a trend. So the belief is that the Federal Reserve won't move next week, but August is another story. International conditions, I put mild on both sides here, and part of it is all timing. One is that we started to see South Korea coming back quite strongly, Thailand's stronger, Japan hopefully has bottomed out and is turning the corner. And so if that happens a little bit faster than what we're projecting, then our forecast, economic scenario would even be stronger than what we are forecasting. Likewise, on the downside, Japan, you never know. There's times when they will come out with new policies to get their economy started, and then the next week they make statements that they will no longer follow any further policies because they're afraid it's going to go too fast. It could go either way. Our outlook, though, in our forecast, our middle-of-the-road forecast, does look for a mild return to those Asian economies. In terms of inflation, that's more of a moderate threat to our forecast, especially as we've seen most recent news that just came out today. We've had energy prices going up rapidly. The danger here is the slowdown will occur because we go back up to the macroeconomic policies where Greenspan then says we need to raise interest rates, slow the economy down to get rid of that inflation. The stock market, I don't believe anybody in their heart, truly if they search and call where the stock market's going to go. So I put 50-50 on both sides here. And really, I think it is. All indications are it still could continue, still could do well. But I'll put it 50-50 on both. Consumer spending is one of the keys. And the consumer's been spending more than their income now from the end of 1998 through this first quarter of 1999, a negative savings rate. But if we take a look at the wealth of families, they can do so. They can be doing a negative savings rate for a time. But if that wealth disappears, and if the stock market makes a major correction, they wouldn't be able to continue on that path. And even if the stock market does stay, even at its level now, the belief is that families really can't keep this sort of negative savings rate going. And so they're going to slow down their consumption spending from the levels that they were at. Not a dramatic slowdown, but enough in order to slow the economy down a little bit. And then lastly, Y2K that's coming along. We have worked into our forecast, actually, a mild increase for the economy as we come up to 2000. But then we don't believe there's going to be major disruption. So all those households that have stacked the cupboards with canned foods and everything else and businesses that have built up inventories because they're afraid there's going to be major disruptions, need to work those down as we get into 2000. And so you have a mild bump up and you have a mild bump down, but nothing to cause great problems in the economy. So overall, our look is that we're looking for a return to a little bit stronger growth than we saw in 1998, not as strong a growth for the Oregon economy as 94 through 97. And likewise, this forecast, which is a little bit stronger than our March forecast, does affect our tax revenue forecast. And so I'd like to turn that over to Sarah Gates then for those tax revenue forecasts.
Thank you, Tom.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gates with the Office of Economic Analysis, and I'm going to give you the May 15th revenue forecast. I'd like you to turn to page 7 of your handout. In summary, just to sort of set the stage, we've lowered the forecast of revenue for the 97-99 biennium by $78 million. We are still above the 2% personal income tax kicker threshold, just barely. And as a result, we are forecasting an increase of $42.5 million in combined general fund lottery resources for next biennium, the 99-01 biennium. So before I get into lots of the details, I wanted to give you a little sense of the longer-term picture and what the trends are for the general fund and lottery revenue, and that's where we start on page 7. The two graphs in front of you show personal income tax and corporate income taxes. The gray bars are the May 15th forecast. The white portion or clear portion on top shows you what revenue could be if the kicker and federal pension refunds were not paid out. The black line is the previous forecast, so it directly compares to the gray bars. And as you can see from both charts, long term, we do expect the revenues from these two major tax sources to continue growing. The forecasts have both changed in the near term slightly, but long term, the trend is the same. For the personal income tax, we expect revenues to grow 5 to 6% a year. So that leaves, you know, about 12% of biennial increase in personal income tax revenues. You can see from the comparison between the black line and the gray bars in the 2000-2001 area, we've slightly raised the forecast of personal income taxes for next biennial compared to the last forecast. Looking at the bottom of the page in the corporate income tax chart, you can see that the low point for corporate income tax revenues, at least in recent history, is fiscal year 1999, and we have lowered that forecast compared to the March forecast. And there's a couple reasons for this. We've seen very, very strong refunds coming from tax year 97. Corporations are closing out their 97 tax year, and they way overpaid. In addition, they have kicker refunds for those that year that they're using. That and slightly softer corporate profit forecast has lowered the forecast for fiscal year 1999. We're also slightly lower for the 2000-2001 fiscal years, but then after that, there's only some slight differences in the forecast. I'd like you to turn to page 8 now, and the graph will show you the total general fund revenues. And the story there is the same. The pension refunds and the kicker refunds have distorted revenues, but the last forecast both have long-term growth built into them, and that follows along with the long-term pattern of economic growth in the state that we expect to not grow as fast as we did in the 95, 96, and 97 period, but definitely faster than the U.S. At the bottom of the page, you can see how the kickers and pension refunds have distorted the revenue patterns. Whenever you hear what the increase between biennia is, it's very much distorted in terms of what actually happened versus what the true economics would have happening to revenues. The gray bar shows actual collections. The black bar shows, if you remove the effects of the large refunds we've been paying out recently, what really would be happening. In the 95-97 biennial, we had 18% revenue growth, and that was phenomenal. When you take out the effects of the kicker, it was 23%, which is even more phenomenal. This biennial, we're going to see revenues increase by 7%, but if we weren't paying out the large refunds, we actually would have had a 13% increase in revenues. And next biennia, it looks like we're having an extraordinary rebound in personal in the general fund because it's going up 19%, but it's off of a lower base than it would be otherwise. So in true economic terms, it's only going up 10%. And then over the long term, we see it growing 11%. You get to the same point with each of these charts, but it's just the fluctuations from biennia to biennia are very distorted when you take those kickers into account. I'd like to give you the same perspective for lottery because it's an important source of revenues, and that forecast has been changing, at least in the long term, quite dramatically over the last year. The chart at the top of page 9 shows the lottery forecast for May and for March compared to each other. The black bar is May, the gray bar is March. The first two biennia on the chart, the current and the 9901, are basically the same. We've only done a slight revision to the 9901. But in the out years, we have lowered the forecast. The reason for that is over the last year, we've been taking a very close look at all the lottery gains and what is truly driving them long term. We can't just assume that because they've grown in the past, they're going to continue growing. Players are getting bored with gains. They've gone past the top part of their product life cycle, more competition. A lot of factors are coming into play. The reason for the most recent decrease is our closer examination of the video forecast. And what we have decided is that since we can't expect that there are going to be any more terminals out there in the state, lottery is really starting to manage video terminals, and in fact, can actually lower the number as the integrated terminal management plan to try and get more revenue per terminal. But what's also happening is the games are very stale, the machines are old, they're starting to replace them, but that's going to take time. There's also the possibility of increased competition from the tribes in addition to the existing competition. So we can't expect the dollars per terminal to significantly increase over time. And the combined result of that is that basically you get a flat video lottery forecast, and that is pushed down the forecast in the out years. Looking to the bottom of the page, you can see how this lower level of resources plus a combined higher level of dedicated funding is impacting your ability to have discretion in the use of the lottery resources. I'm sure all of you are aware that we have the Education Endowment Fund taking 15%. Next biennium, the Parks and Natural Resources Fund will get another 15%. Debt service on lottery bonds is increasing. If any more lottery bonds are passed, that will also add to the debt service. The net result is a declining level of resources that can go to discretionary programs. Mm-hmm. And when you add the state school fund piece, it means that there's very little left. Now, if you'll turn to page 10, I'll give you the actual numbers for the forecast. The top of the page shows you the current biennium, the 97-99 biennium. General fund resources, which is beginning balance plus revenues, has been lowered and at $76 million. The main reason for that is our estimate of federal pension refunds has increased pretty significantly. We've actually sent out $208 million so far this biennium. That's since February when the refunds started going out. We anticipate $225 million going out before June 30th. Our prior forecast had 184 total, but only about 165 of it going out this biennium. Department of Revenue has placed additional staff and made it a top priority to get every refund out the door as fast as possible for those that are legal to pay at this time. And so that, plus we've gotten more filings than we anticipated. We thought there'd be some difficulty in finding everybody, but it appears that they're getting those refund claims in. So that has lowered the forecast. In addition, we've lowered the corporate income tax forecast by $36 million, and I explained why when we were looking at the charts, but basically higher refunds and slightly lower corporate profits. The lottery forecast is unchanged. The net result means that you have total resources of $9.7 billion for this biennium, a decrease of $76 million. We are forecasting a personal income tax kicker at this point. We are very slightly over the 2% threshold. By that, I mean $2.6 million. Or 2.03% of the close of session. That's a very slight margin. To put it in perspective, the state collects between $10 and $12 million a day in withholding taxes. That's every day. So you can see that compared to just the sort of withholding revenues coming in, this is a very small amount of money. The best way for you to think about this is that we're right on the line of whether there's a kicker or not a kicker. There's a very good chance we could be under and not have a kicker. There's a very good chance we could have a bigger kicker. It all depends on how those revenues come in, literally down to the day and the timing of when some people send in estimated payments. There's a lot of factors that could adjust the amount and make it whether or not we have a kicker or not. We will not know until August when we have all revenues in on June 30th as to whether or not there will be a kicker, and that's when we will certify it to the Department of Revenue. But this lower resource forecast for 97-99 lowers the ending balance for the current biennium to $329.6 million. That does carry forward into the 99-01 biennium, which you see at the bottom of the page. The general fund resources for the 9901 biennia are now forecast to be $10.2 billion. That's an increase of $43.8 million compared to the March forecast. There are several offsetting reasons for this. We have a higher personal income tax forecast, and that goes along with our improved economic forecast. We have a smaller ticker, so it means smaller refunds paid out in the fiscal year 2000. Plus, we have lowered the amount of federal pension refunds we think will be going out after June 30th because they appear to be processing them much faster. Offsetting these increases are a lower corporate income tax forecast and a lower other revenue forecast and a lower beginning balance. Lottery resources, which is beginning balance plus lottery revenues, is $1.3 million lower for a total of $569.1 million for the 9901 biennia. What this means in terms of the dedicated distributions is that the Education Endowment Fund and the Parks and Natural Resources Fund will each receive $200,000 less than we had previously forecast. When you eliminate, that accounts for $400,000 of the $1.3 million, and as a result, the actual reduction in discretionary resources is only $900,000. So your combined total resources of general fund and lottery are now totaling $10.7 billion. This is $42.5 million more than you had in March, or 0.4%. The following two pages in the press packet I'm not going to go through in great detail, but it does give you...
Isn't that a change?
Yes, that's my letter.
You said $42.5 million more in March?
Mm-hmm.
This here says 43.8. Is that just general fund and lottery? I'm sure. Okay, sorry. Thank you.
If I may continue, Madam Chair. Page 11 gives you line-by-line detail on the 9901 and the 9799 biennial, looking at corporate and personal and other revenues, and a little more detail on lottery. The final page of the press packet does show what the average refund would be if the ticker does stick at the current level of 2.03% above the close of session estimate, or $153.9 million. That would give a refund of 14% of the 1998 personal income tax liability. And with this, I'd like to conclude my presentation. Tom and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for our guests? No? No questions? Senator Minister.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question to Sarah regarding if the kicker does not tick, and the assumption is that we're out of session at the time that we actually certified it, then those dollars would then go to the ending balance. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So there'd be no way then we can allocate those because of the uncertainty. So those dollars would have to come at a little later time.
Madam Chair, Senator Dineski, that is correct. They would roll forward into the ending balance.
Which, Senator Metzger, I might comment that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Both the governor's budget and the legislative budget are carrying a $56 million ending fund balance, which I think many of our fiscally wise people will tell us isn't really very prudent. So if it were to grow to $200 million, it probably really would be not a problem from a fiscal point of view. Although I would like to see people get their refunds too. Senator Trump.
Over time, there's been a trend, regardless of the forecast in May, for that ending balance to grow rather tremendously and become about a half a billion by the time we get to the next forecast. So you see a possibility of that happening again?
Madam Chair, Senator Trill, of course there's always that possibility. This is a middle-of-the-road forecast. We could have lower revenues. We could have higher revenues. The reason that ending balance has grown so much in recent periods, especially last biennia, we had incredible June estimated payments, which pushed up the kicker amount to $431 million and in turn pushed up the ending balance to $97.99. At the moment, we are giving this forecast as our best estimate based on the current economic outlook, and so this is what we expect.
Yeah, and I know that's true. I also know, though, that if you just look at the track record for about 20 years for most biennials, most of these forecasts in May have been under what the actual revenue has been substantially, and there's a lot bigger maintaining balance for the next plan. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily bad. I'm not arguing that that's bad. I think that's good because it gives us a start. But also, as we think about, you know, how we fund our needs, we need to keep that in mind because we have to make our decisions now based on our revenues. But by the time we get to the next biennium, we'll have had more revenues this biennium probably than this forecast will indicate.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess I would like to put beyond the for a minute. In response to Senator Crow's observation, I think there are some differences that we need to look at. For instance, seasonal employment has been very strong in the manufacturing sectors and lumber and wood products and food processing and exports as commodities may not be as strong as performers that have in the past due to the Asian Pacific crisis and the loss of national and international markets, especially in wheat. But the other issues that I'd like to focus on are the statistical reviews that we have with the budget forecast, and that includes the idea that Oregon's per capita income compares well with national growth in per capita income. I suggest to you that's true in 5 Oregon counties only, and that per capita income in 31 Oregon counties lies significantly below the 5 metro Oregon counties, even to $10,000 on a per capita. So the fact is that metro area strength in the economy is performing, carrying the bulk of the tax revenue, and we are having still significant employment and production dislocations in the world, and that if we just look at the averages and not beyond the statistics, we're getting a picture of a robust performance in the Oregon economy that doesn't exist outside of a relatively small geographic area in the North and Mid-Atlantic Valley. I guess I just want our colleagues to be cognizant that when we're talking about the relatively strong performance and a fairly optimistic forecast, that that may not be true all through the state. Look at the other counties and beyond the statistics.
Thank you, Senator. I think that most of us are very concerned about the economic conditions in rural Oregon, and it would be the hope of, I think, most of us to help out with some economic development to those areas if we can accommodate that in the budget. Okay, Wesson.
Just to further augment Senator Farioli's comment, while that's true, the 5 Oregon counties are doing quite well relative to Oregon standards, and the 31 are doing poorly relative to those 5. Those 5 counties still lag behind Oregon average wage and U.S. per capita income. So while the 5 counties are doing much better relatively, we are not doing great as a state compared to the rest of the country.
Madam Chair. Senator Z.
Thank you. Senator, you said that we won't know whether the picture will take or not by August. Why August?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the reason that we have to wait until August is that we have to get all the way through the June 30th period, and then there's something called the 30-day, there's a 30-day period in which revenues associated with the June period will be collected. So up until July 30th, we won't really know what true June revenues are, and then it takes time for that to get in the accounting system and for us to do all the calculations and get all the information in. So we'll get a full picture of the fiscal year's revenues by early to mid-August and then make that certification.
Another question. And the ticker, if it ticks, is $153.9 million, is stated on page 10.
That's correct.
Okay.
Are there further questions or comments? I would just like to say, Senator Crow, you did make a good point that usually our ending fund balance is low, but I think we should all keep in mind this is a middle-of-the-road forecast. And as Ms. Gates said, unfortunately, it could go down as well as go up. And I find it very alarming on page 4 to see the manufacturing employment down for this year, and I see that you're projecting it to go back up
but that is a sector of the economy where a lot of the wages are very good, and I think do fill a lot of the personal income tax side, of our Oregon income, and that, you know, that is something that concerns me. So I think we all must be aware of it and try to do prudent things during this legislative session.
I'm sure. Just comment on your comments tonight. I think they're fine. It is awfully important, though. The May forecast is more important than any other forecast, in part because it sets the parameters for when we budget and how much we have to spend. It also sets the parameters for the kicker for the next time. So this one needs to be accurate.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
All right, we will move back into our agenda with Senate Bill 259, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. With the forecast in hand, now we look at Senate Bill 259A and GOES. This reopens tax years 91 through 94, which are currently closed to taxpayers claiming refunds on taxes paid on the federal retirement income attributable to employment before October 1st, 1991. That relates to the Davis versus Michigan case, which was settled on that date. It extends to April 16th, 2001, the period for which time federal retirees may file claims for refund. It also establishes the procedures for claims of deceased federal retirees and deceased federal pension beneficiaries. Finally, the measure directs the Department of Revenue not to make the refunds before July 1st, 1999. The General Government Subcommittee discussed the fiscal impact of the legislation on the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue estimates that it would need $84,909 of general funds and the equivalent of 1.23 full-time employee for the 9901 and 71,606 of general fund and 0.26 full-time employees for 2001-2003 to process these refunds. Responding with the taxpayers, providing documentation, and conducting hearings on appeals for refunds. The subcommittee also discussed the impact of the payment date of the refunds relative to the kicker. A motion to adopt an amendment to require payment of refunds before July 1st, 1999 failed in the subcommittee. No other amendments were proposed. The General Government Subcommittee recommends approval of the Senate Bill 259.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have had distributed to the members dash A6 amendment that accomplishes the same thing that Representative Butler referred to in the subcommittee, specifically the dash 6 amendment would require that the $107 million payment be made before July 1, 1999. The reason for this is that I believe we have a legal, if not a moral, obligation to pay our debts and pay them in a timely way. We're incurring about $30,000 to $33,000 a day in interest, about $1 million a month on the unpaid balance of what we owe a portion of the federal retirees. This amendment would authorize the Department of Revenue to make those payments as quickly as possible, therefore saving taxpayer dollars by not incurring undue interest. And I'd urge the members here to consider this amendment. I think it's a prudent way to handle the state's business, and I encourage adoption.
Thank you, Representative Leonard. We try not to make amendments in full committee, and I would ask you to, if you want to go down this route, rather than to make an amendment here, to make a motion to move the bill back to sub.
I don't think we want to get into the habit of making amendments in full committee unless we have an emergency situation, which this is really not an emergency situation. So I would ask you to consider that consider making your motion to move it back to committee.
Well, Madam Chair, I would refer you to Rules of the House 822, which authorize amendments in the Ways and Means Committee if the amendments deal with fiscal or revenue impact issues. So I'm interested in knowing what rule that might be that you would provide for me that would indicate that the full Ways and Means is not authorized to make amendments, and if so, I'd be glad to withdraw my motion.
It's not a rule, it's just kind of tradition.
Representative, it's basically custom of Ways and Means. We have a standing rule amongst most Ways and Means members and the LFO staff that if there is to be a bill amended, the proper procedural motion is to return it back to committee and have the subcommittee deal with it. The reason is we try to prevent bills from being amended in full Ways and Means, as well as prevent bills being amended on the floor of the House or the Senate, for the same reason that the subcommittee has the basis of information, has discussed the issue, has in-depth knowledge, and the rest of us perhaps are not in a position to realize the difference. So typically, historically, what has been used is if you want a motion to amend, you send it back to the subcommittee.
Madam Chair,
I'm
sure I don't have to call Senator Hannon this. There's a few people in the entire legislature I respect more. But I did bring this up in subcommittee, and I believe that probably in 99% of the issues that we deal with, you're probably correct. It would be more appropriate to refer that to go back. This particular issue has implications beyond when we pay the federal retirees. This particular issue has implications in the case of the budget. It has implications, in fact, when he dies. And if I had some assurance that the co-chairs, in fact, would consider this amendment and send the budget back to, agree to send it back to the subcommittee, I'd be glad to withdraw the motion. But if I agree to withdraw the motion and we simply just kill a motion to refer this back, I'm not interested in withdrawing the motion. This is a significant issue that has far-ranging implications for the state and its finances. And I think we are all prepared to understand what those issues are. But like I said, if I had some assurance that we could send this back and at least discuss it, I'm more than happy to withdraw the motion.
Robert Sandler, this was discussed in the sub, and the motion was defeated. However, I will go along with you and allow your motion here, but I want to make it very clear to full committee members that this should not be a habit, that we do not bring amendments to full committee, and I'm going to honor Representative Leonard's request this morning so we can vote on this amendment, but I just please, in the future, if you have a problem with the bill as it got out of sub, make your motion to re-refer it to the sub, not to amend it in full committee. I'm going to honor that request today.
Madam Chair, let me just say, I think it's very important for the legislature to operate by rules.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been frustrating for me over the past few months for us to, at times, waver from what the written rules say and allude to some other procedure. In a time of term limits more than ever, I think it's very important that if we want to put that in our rules, that we don't do amendments for Ways and Means, that's fine. Then I know what the rules are. But frankly, to come in here on a Friday morning and be told, well, this is not something we're doing, it's just an understanding I'm not comfortable with. So I appreciate your request, but I don't want to mislead you and think that I wouldn't do something like this again in the future, because it is authorized in our rules to do this.
I think it's also important to honor tradition, and we do have traditions here. Senator Fraley.
Madam Co-Chair, your observation is correct. We did hear this amendment in our subcommittee, and the discussion of the subcommittee revolved around the two issues that one of which the proponent of the amendment has discussed, and that is the relative prudence of not extending interest dollars while we delay payment on the obligation, which is their obligation to account. But the discussion there was that we were looking at a penny wise and pound foolish approach, since the savings, when compared to the $107 million effect in the budget for this biennium, was the real impact and effect of this amendment. And so we carefully considered the impact of a retaining over-collected income taxes and the prospect of not returning those to taxpayers. And I feel we're obligated to do, and other members of the subcommittee also felt we were obligated to do. So in regards to the motion that's been made for reconsideration of this amendment, I think this amendment is offered in a good faith by the representative, and I think the discussion is worthy to have. I appreciate the chair hearing this motion, but I think this motion, in fact, has been discussed. All the implications were understood by the subcommittee, and I just don't think the motion deserves our consideration and support at this level.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Trump.
We do have rules, and I do think that if we don't want the rules to be operative, we ought to change the rules. It is true that we've had this sort of tradition that we send things back, and that's fine as a tradition, but I know that in the past, in the years I've been here, we've seen amendments considered in the full Ways and Means Committee that we have a tradition of occasionally doing this. So I think the Senator's right to insist in this instance that the rules be acknowledged. This is an important issue, and it's worth us thinking about it publicly and doing something about it. The Department of Revenue is fully prepared immediately to pay out the claims of Oregonians who rightfully are entitled to this money back. They're ready to do that. They've got the claims in hand, really. All we have to do is authorize them to make these payments to people who have filed their applications. And if we do it immediately, it does save us a couple million dollars. If we do it the way the legislation calls for, that we're probably going to approve, because this way it came out of the committee, it's going to cost us money. It's not cost effective to do it that way. It will have a possible effect upon whether the kicker kicks. And that, I suppose, is worth considering. The kicker now is, I think, in a precarious kind of situation. It may or not kick. This might keep it from kicking. But it seems to me clearly that if you look at what's cost-effective for the state, doing it the way Representative Leonard suggests is the cost-effective way to do it. It saves the state money. It doesn't hold back money waiting. Simply because we don't want to pay it now, because that will might get in the way of the kicker kicking.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator. Further discussion on the APHIS amendment?
Okay, and so we're discussing the merits.
Yes, we are. Okay. As I said, I would honor Representative Leonard's request. We are discussing the merits of the amendment.
Madam Chair, I will support the amendment, and I would draw the committee's attention to the political reality that the Senate Bill 259, as it came out of committee, will upset the revenue for the coming biennium, because we are spending funds out of the coming biennium, and as such is subject to the governor's veto. And so that is another factor that we might want to take into consideration in terms of having to revisit this issue. I think it is important to pay our debts. I think that's the honorable thing to do. I think it is appropriate that we, in fact, move forward with the payment. I have constituents who are calling me and saying that they need the money and that they need it, and it would save us money to do it. And holding back on paying this debt artificially in order to have available a kicker seems to be contradictory, and I think that Senate Bill 259, as written, will be in danger of the governor's veto, and then we'll have to do this over. So that's another thing to think about as we're considering the motion.
Thank you, Representative Ross. Further discussion? Senator Metzger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would support this amendment also. One of the things that during my many months on the streets, a number of you were as well last year, other than K-12 education, I heard extensively when I was going into a federal retiree about their refund and wanting to know what's this bill we have to have, et cetera, et cetera. And I know a lot of you have as well. And one of the commitments I made was that we would try to get those dollars out as soon as possible. This is an opportunity to make that commitment as soon as possible. When we made the big fiscal impact, moving to 01 of 899 or paying this now does not fall with great understanding on those federal retirees. That's inside baseball. They want to know, why can't you just pay it now? And I think in honor of that commitment, I would support this amendment.
Further discussion?
Since we are discussing it, I guess I've made a commitment to my constituents also in terms of trying to get some money paid to them. I am concerned about the total dollars and the impact that it's going to have, and hopefully if this does pass and gets to the floor, we can look at that and have a good discussion about what we should or shouldn't be doing in terms of total dollar amount. But I've gone on record, frankly, as far as trying to help through this. I think that Senator Metzger is correct. It's a little tough for us to walk out of the building and say, no, you don't get any money for another 2 years. It just appears so disingenuous. And when we were on the campaign trail, I tried to be honest with my voters, and so I'm in a position where I think it's the right thing to do and if I go for the amendment.
Madam Chair, I speak in opposition to the amendment. To me, and this is a big issue, I've received hundreds of phone calls on this issue, and I hope the federal retirees that are getting this will appreciate the fact that we're doing this, and it will be expedited by July 1st. If we look at this process, I've never seen any department of state government that all of a sudden can make payments. If we're a month and a half from July 1st, that's when the payments should be made. I would speak in opposition to the motion and, of course, to amend and before Senate Bill 259.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think it is actually a little disingenuous to say that we would wait two years to make this payment. We're extending this 24 hours, June 30th to July 1st. And so to say we are not paying federal retirees for 2 years is simply wrong. I have made that commitment as well to the federal retirees. I want them to get paid too. But you know what? I've also made a commitment to my constituents across the board that I would not take from their kicker funds either. This way, with this bill, allows us to do both. And furthermore, we heard from the Department of Revenue they are currently paying the federal retirees as we speak. That was a court case. They are repaying those that were part of that court case. It is additional retirees that would receive the class action funds that will go out on July 1st. So we're only talking about 24 hours, not 2 years.
Madam Chair, I also speak against this motion. I made commitments as well to my federal retirees, and I believe I'm keeping those commitments by saying all we're going to do is delay it by 1 day. We're not delaying it 2 years. We're delaying it 1 day. I made those commitments, and I believe in keeping commitments. And I believe that for us to be involved in this kind of debate and discussion, I can count, and I know what the votes are, and I can see where the train is headed. And I'm not interested in delaying this process any longer, because the biggest commitment that we all make when we come to this building is that we subscribe to the Constitution. The Constitution requires the legislature to do one thing, balance a budget. It doesn't require us to pass 4,200 bills. It requires us to balance the budget. Once we achieve that, we can go home. If this means getting us out of here in a timely manner and balancing the budget, so be it. I'm prepared to support it, whether you pay it on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Okay. Senator.
Madam Chair, the way we're going to do it, we're going to put off paying the additional retirees who qualify and have really got their applications in and are ready to be paid. We're going to put them off until we paid them in the next biennium. They can be paid the very first day of the next biennium, that's true, and those checks can begin to go out. But at least it's a couple months or more in which we're not paying them. The department's ready to pay them right now. If we would say, if this amendment would pass, they could begin to pay them right now and save at least 2 months or more of interest. And that's about $1 million a month that we could save if we would pass this amendment over what the committee has reported out.
Thank you, Senator. I'll ask Ken Butler.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Having heard the Department of Revenue budget and having visited with some of those folks, I say that they are presently working those claims. There is some work that has to be done to gather all of the claim information to authenticate, and they are presently working those claims. They're doing that within their current budget. The state treasurer is, in fact, investing the funds that are involved here, the principal amount, 100% of that, which is accumulated, and he's also investing 100% of all the interest. Recognize that the interest that we owe the federal retirees on these back claims, assuming that Senate Bill 260 passes, then what happens is that we've got both principal and interest that the treasurer is presently compounding interest on, and so when we talk about how much he is able to earn, he's been able to return much more than the 9% that we're paying out to the retirees. Finally, we've talked about commitment to the retirees. Those after 19, for the open years, all we're talking about is those unopened years, those years that are not presently open, 91 through 94, with regard to the fact that we're going to go ahead and, by legislation, we hope be able to open those up and an opportunity following the hearing to meet with the attorney on behalf of the claimants. And his indication was this is exactly what we anticipated would happen, that the bill would be passed and then sometime in the mid-year that we would be paid. So he did not have any objection to the language as it was passed out of our committee without this proposed amendment.
I don't want to close down debate because we're having an excellent discussion here this morning, but I've just been informed that the Senate is under call. I have told them we need 10 more minutes. Are there further comments on the motion? Representative Schrader?
Just a comment. I mean, I read the existing wording in the bill here. It says no refunds may be paid under this section prior to July 1st, 1999. It does not guarantee that any payments will be made after July 1st, 1999. And under the legal agreement that was reached on this, no payments have to be made until after 2001. So there is conceivably a two-year period, depending on what the Department of Revenue and the governor want to do, that people who have been waiting since 1991 will get absolutely nothing. So I do have, a legitimate concern.
Thank you, Representative Schrader. I'd like to say a few words and then let Representative close, and we'll go at it that way. I, too, believe that this is an obligation that we have, and I feel very strongly about this obligation to pay the federal retirees. We have accommodated this payment in our budget for the 9901 biennium, and we fully anticipate these refunds to be paid on July 1 as accommodated in our budget.
So I too feel that we need to get them paid as quickly as possible. And I don't minimize the $2 million in interest payments. It's always prudent to save money. However, I feel that it would be wrong to take away the over-collected taxes, the kicker refunds, from the people of Oregon who are expecting that, and many of them are federal retirees as well. And I think most of the federal retirees would be very unhappy with us to take their kicker check that they will get probably this December away from them just because we paid this out a few weeks early. So we have an opportunity here to do two right things: pay them on July 1 and also give them their kicker refunds in December, as well as the rest of Oregonians. That's my plan.
Thank you. And I do appreciate the debate here this morning on this. And I also want to make it clear that I respect the position of those that support sending out the kicker dollars. I also respect the decision of the court. And I respect the rights of those we owe money to get their money when we have the money to pay them. Right now we have projected $153.9 million beyond what we thought we'd have as an ending fund balance to pay this obligation from. In my view, we have competing interests. We have a law that says if the kicker kicks, we pay everything beyond the 2%. Everything, if the kicker kicks, we pay everything that is a surplus beyond what we're projecting. We have a court decision that says that these federal retirees were not treated as state retirees were, and we owe them this money. I do think it's important for me to say one thing, though. I mean, I have enjoyed this debate with the exception of the characterization of this amendment as disingenuous. I don't appreciate that. I think it's important that this be looked at its merits. I think it's in the best interest of Oregon, and I think it deserves the respect that any of our positions deserve. And the argument that keeping the money now, though we owe it, because it makes more it brings us a greater return than the interest that we owe, the 9% we owe, is flabbergasting to me. To say that we would keep the money that we owe federal retirees because we make more money off it than we owe them in interest is an insult. And I don't support that. So I would hope that we could pass this amendment. It would be the right thing to do, and would also be good for Oregon. Thank you.
Madam Chair, point of personal privilege. Mm-hmm. It was just indicated that somebody said, or that the comment disingenuous was made. If you had listened closely, Representative Leonard, the comment I made about disingenuousness was that we would wait 24 months or 2 years to pay this, not that your amendment was disingenuous.
Thank you.
Thank you for clarifying that. The roll call vote on this, the motion is to adopt the -86 amendment. Mr. Simpson?
Senator Stupak?
No.
Hammond?
No.
E?
No.
Go?
Aye.
Bryant?
No.
Ferrioli?
No.
Fisher?
No.
Aye.
Kim?
Go.
Representative Ross?
Aye.
Westland?
No.
Beverly?
No.
Leonard?
Aye.
Schrader?
Aye.
Butler?
No.
Dennis?
No.
Hesses?
No.
Chairman Kulchip?
No. The A6 amendment having failed to receive the required majority is not passed. Do I have a motion to move the bill? I guess I do. Senator, Representative Butler had previously made the motion. We have a motion before us to move Senate Bill 259. With the due pass recommendation, I believe we'll take a roll call vote on this also, Mr. Simpson.
Senator Chutub?
Aye.
Hammond?
Aye.
Keith?
Aye.
Joe?
Aye.
Bryant?
Aye.
Carioli?
Aye.
Bishop?
Aye.
Esther?
No.
Kim?
Aye.
No.
Westland?
Aye.
Measley?
Aye.
Leonard?
No.
Schrader?
Aye.
Butler?
Aye.
Dennis?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator?
Aye. Senate Bill 259, having received the required majority, is passed 2-4 with a due pass recommendation, and we're showing Senator Farioli as carrier. Thank you very much. Let's try to move quickly to Senate Bill 260, Representative Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 260A in gross establishes a contraction from taxable income for federal pension income attributable to federal employment before October 1, 1991. It excludes refunds of taxes paid on such income from federal adjusted gross income for the purpose of determining eligibility for Oregon's senior citizens' property tax deferral program. The measure also allows the Department of Revenue to cancel income tax assessments imposed on federal pension income. The General Government Subcommittee discussed the minimal fiscal impact of the legislation on the Department of Revenue. The Department expects that additional workload will be absorbed by existing staff. No amendments by the Subcommittee were made. We recommend approval of this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Leonard. Is there any comments on Senate Bill 260? Hearing none, are there any objections to the passage of Senate Bill 260? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 260 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm showing Senator Trill with the carrier. Let's see. I don't know. Do we have time to move through the grant applications?
We need to
move to the grant applications. Okay. Just before we move to the grant applications, I would like everyone to acknowledge June Barber. She is our full committee clerk and LFO fiscal impact coordinator, who many of you probably had the pleasure of working with. I certainly have. June, as you can see, is going to be taking maternity leave the imminent anticipation of the birth of her second child, and we wish her well, and we hope she comes back soon and shows us the baby. We're all excited about it, and we do hope, however, that we are adjourned long before your leave is up soon. But thank you so much for your work. We've all appreciated it, and just give you the best wishes.
And Madam Chair, I hope we're adjourned before the child enters preschool.
Thank you, Representative Winter. Okay, thanks so much, Jim. All right, we will go to the first grant application, which is Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Services Division, Support for Families of Persons with Developmental Disabilities, Senator Steven.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The Human Resources Subcommittee recommends that the Awakening Committee approve the request for Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division to apply for a federal grant for up to $200,000 to help develop resources for families of persons with developmental disabilities. The $66,000 state match requirement will be met with private donations and in-kind contributions. The ARC of Multnomah County has made $10,000 donation to the project with an ongoing general fund commitment. There is no ongoing, general fund commitment. A competitive grant is a time award. However, if we receive the grant, the state is eligible for the second non-competitive grant. It would use this to expand these efforts in additional counties. The subcommittee recommends approval of the request.
Thank you, Senator Teachout. Are there any questions for Senator Teachout on the grant application? No. Are there any objections to the approval of this grant application? Hearing and seeing none, the grant is approved. Next is the grant for the Health Division, Children's Oral Health, Representative Ross.
The Human Resources Subcommittee recommends the Awakening Committee approve a request from the Health Division to apply to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services for a $200,000 Oral Health Integrated Systems Development Grant. This grant would provide $50,000 a year for 4 years to improve the oral health of young children. Grant funds would be used for a contractor to work with the Oregon Health Plan providers to increase the number of children between ages 1 and 3 receiving dental exams and preventive services. Activities would also include training dentists and techniques for examining young children and an appropriate method for suspending dental treatment until very young children are old enough to receive definitive care. The grant application deadline is May 17, 1999. The award is expected by midsummer. There is no general fund matching requirement. If the grant is awarded, the division, accompanied by representatives of Early Childhood Cavity Prevention Coalition, will come to the emergency board for expenditure limitation inquiry. We recommend approval.
Thank you, Representative Ross. Any questions for Representative Ross? Okay. Are there any objections to the approval of this grant application? Hearing and seeing none, the grant is approved. And the next grant is Health Division Bioterrorism. Can't say that word today. Senator Bryant.
Thank you.
Bureau. The Subcommittee on Human Resources recommends approval of this grant application by the Health Division to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for Federal Public Health Preparedness to respond to bioterrorism grants. This is the first year of a five-year program. It will include responsive activities for preparedness and planning for readiness assessment, surveillance, and epidemiology capacity, laboratory capacity for rapid confirmation of bioterrorism agents, and the development of the communication infrastructure needed for effective response. The application is due today. Mid-August, they'll come to the e-board for the necessary expenditure limitations, position authority. There's no general funding.
Okay. Are there any questions for Senator Bryant on this grant application? Are there any objections to the approval of this grant? Hearing and seeing none, the grant is approved, and I want to thank everyone for their good hard work today. Excellent committee meeting, and we will see you all next week. We are adjourned.